hey, before we begin today's show, we're all going through some tough times right now, but here at ESPN, we're trying to help you get through them. We got word this week the Chicago Bulls documentary series, The Last Dance, will debut later this month, which we're all excited for. But if you need to pass the time until then, ESPN podcasts are still in full swing. And just this week, we've put out new daily episodes of Baseball Tonight with Buster Olney, and of course, ESPN Daily with Mina Kimes. Obviously, there's still a lot going on in the world of pro football. So we've got new episodes of the Adam Schefter podcast and the Bill Barnwell show. If you're interested in listening to any of these shows, you can listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcast, rate, review, all that stuff. Hello and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast presented by Goodyear, one of my all-time favorite companies. Not just because we're presenting a sponsor, because my family has been tied to them for 50 plus years, Akron, Ohio. Joining us from Boston is Jackie McMullen. We have the A-team here for this particular podcast. Jackie, I hope you're doing well.
I have no ties to Goodyear, but I am doing fine. Everybody here is relatively healthy as far as we know, but who would know? Because the only person I ever see is my husband, and we're both hanging in there.
That's the way it should be. Joining us from Dallas, the Dallas Metroplex, is Tim McMahon. I used to tell where everybody was because we were always spread across the country, but you know, now I don't even have to ask.
Howdy, partners.
Lean Cuisine Pizza Update.
We are in need of a run. Mm. Let's see. Let me open this bad boy up. We are down to 1, 2, 3, 4. And then a couple of these Healthy Choice Power Bowls.
Mm.
Got some turkey sandwich stuff, but yeah, it's time for a grocery run.
Fruit, Tim, fruit. You're going to get scurvy. Arr. Eat fruit. Come on, eat some fruit.
My
Tim.
Daughter made me a fancy smoothie today, so I got some
Ooh,
fruit.
Yeah. I love that. Good girl.
All right, very good. All right, well, we had some actually pleasant news for a change this week when ESPN announced that the Michael Jordan documentary, which had long been planned to be shown before and in and around the finals, on the off nights of the finals and stuff in June, is now being moved up and is going to be shown in a little under 3 weeks. I believe it's a couple of weeks from 2 weeks from Sunday, maybe.
The 19th. So,
19th.
That is.
Yeah, the 19th.
Okay, so, you know, 2.5 weeks from now. So I just thought we would, just because it triggered so much with so many people, I mean, just the excitement of seeing this doc. If it's 10 episodes, I know they've been working on it for almost 2 years. So, you know they have great interviews and you know they've gone through all of the footage and they have all the stuff. And I'm looking forward to it. Jackie, you covered the entirety, if I'm not mistaken, of Michael Jordan's career in the NBA. How many of those championships were you – how many of those finals wins were you there for?
Oh, I don't know. A lot of them. I might have missed 91. I was pregnant. I did have some kids in there. But, you know, I'll tell you, the moment that I will never forget, and I was there, and you know what I'm talking about because it broke your heart, Brian, as a young person, was the 89 playoffs, Richfield Coliseum.
Oh, yes.
To me, and oh, I yes. saw, I've seen it, almost everything Jordan has done as a pro, not as a college player, and I still think that was the greatest shot he ever made. I still feel that way, and it's called the shot, for those who don't know. There was 3 seconds left.
I can't believe people wouldn't know, but I don't know. Maybe.
Well, maybe not. I don't know.
You but might Jordan, have some whippersnappers.
Jordan rises up, hits, you know, by the way, Craig Yolo did everything right.
And not just rises up, but floated.
Yes, he did. And the thing was, he hit the shot, buzzer beater, wins the game. And by the way, it's only the first round of the playoffs. And
right, back, game five.
And it's a best of five back then is what I was going to say. But it was, I'm telling you, you just knew it was, you knew sometimes, and you guys have been in these experiences where you know the minute you see it, this is an iconic moment. This is a defining moment. It really was like that. And partly because the Cavs were really good. Brad Daugherty was on that team. Mark Price, Ron Harper, Larry Nance, you know, Elo hit the would-be winning layup. That was Elo before that. And he guarded Michael Jordan as well as you possibly could. And I'll tell you something. I ran into Craig Elo after many, many years. Craig Elo was a wonderful player and a great guy, just a really good guy. I ran into him this last year at a Hall of Fame event, a golf event in L.A., and I was, you know, talking with him because I knew him from all those years ago. I would never bring this up. I just never would. But I stood with him and talked with him for probably 25 minutes. And not almost everyone.
Oh, man.
Every single person. That was the first thing they said to Craig Elo. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine being defined by someone else's, you know, the greatest player who ever lived, his greatness? And I've always wondered. That loss was so heartbreaking, so crushing, and he crushed that entire team, and he crushed Craig Elo, who, by the way, did nothing wrong. It's just astounding.
Yeah, it's one of those things that happens in basketball sometimes. In fact, you know, in Cleveland, the play that Elo scored on to give the Cavs the lead was almost too good. The play worked so well that it took, like, no time.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
And, you know, that Cavs team, they won 57 games. They had home court. Obviously, it was the deciding fifth game was in Cleveland, Richfield. Yeah. They had the number three defense in the league.
Yeah.
Number two defense in terms of offensive rating. Number nine offense. That's the kind of team that can really do something. And then, of course, after that year, they traded Ron Harper for Danny Ferry, and the rest is sort of history.
Right, exactly.
And Ron Harper, I think most people, at least our age or younger, remember Ron Harper as a role player for the Chicago Bulls. But Cleveland Cavaliers, Ron Harper was a superstar.
Oh, yeah. No, he was, you know, he was the third leading scorer on that team. I mean, Brad Doherty and Mark Price were the linchpins of that team. But, you know, it was funny. I remember, this is a Jordan story. I had kind of forgot about this, but I covered that series. So I was back and forth and I was at the games. And I was just getting, you know, I'd been around Jordan a little bit because, of course, I was also there for God disguised as Michael Jordan back in against the Celtics in 86. And so I had gotten to know him a little bit, and I was asking about the Cavs, and I remember him saying to me, yeah, they're nice, a little too nice. I remember him saying that to me. I didn't write it. I wasn't interviewing him. We were just talking because guess what? Back then, you talked to players at their locker before the game, after the game. It was a very different – no, it was a very different environment. You got to be around these guys. And you know, he was right. If there was one thing wrong with that Cleveland Cavalier team was they were a little too nice. He was right. They did not have the killer instinct, and by the way, very few do, that Michael Jordan had.
Well, the other thing I'll say is that what people forget, that was at that point was one of Jordan's greatest games. Deciding game five on the road. Remember, he hadn't really won anything yet. He scored 44 in that game, 17 of 32 from the field with 9 rebounds, 6 assists, and just 2 turnovers in 44 minutes. Obviously the shot was the defining moment, but, you know, it was the culmination of a huge game. And earlier in that series, in a 5-game series when it's 1-1, game 3 becomes pivotal. He scored 44 in that game.
Yeah.
As well.
And we had seen this, you know, I mean, it was 86 when he's in the Garden and he's dropping 63 on perhaps one of the greatest basketball teams of all time. I mean, the 1986 Celtics, Brian and Tim, were 40-1 at home. The only game they lost all year at home was to the Portland Trailblazers, and Larry Bird's still mad about it. But, you know, he is. But they had he dropped 63 on them. Played 53 minutes out of 58 minutes in that game. You know, I think he had 22 field goals. He was 19 of 21 from the line in that game. And the God disguised as Michael Jordan, again, for those of you who are too young, that's what Bird said after. I mean, the Celtics did prevail in that game in double overtime, but that's what Bird said after the game. He knew. And, you know, it's funny. In the previous game, game one, He had 48 or 49, a ton of points in game one against Dennis Johnson, one of the best defensive guards in the league. And DJ, after the game, was in the locker room talking to the guys, and he's like, yeah, well, the good news is he had 49 and we won, and don't worry, there's no way that's going to happen again. And DJ was right, of course, because he had 63.
Right.
So, I guess my point was, I watched this young guy play, and 89 to me was everything coming together. But before that, he was already well on his way.
Jack, your memory's good. He had 49.
All right, I knew it was one. A ton.
Do you remember what he had in game three?
I don't.
19.
Yeah, I know that they did some Jordan Rules stuff on him, because years later, when the whole Jordan Rules thing blew up, I remember DJ saying to me, oh, come on, man, we were shading him long before anybody else was. We were shading back in 86. Come on, man. You know.
He still managed to average 44 points a game in the series in the three.
No, he was just incredible. Just incredible. And, you know, the 89 playoffs, it's funny because that was an upset. That was clearly an upset. I mean, Cleveland was the only team better than them in the East that year was the Pistons. And but Jordan went on. They went on, you know, in game one of the next series, he drops 34 on the Knicks in Madison Square Garden. I mean, he was just incredible. And I know there's been some great players since. And, you know, LeBron's one of the greatest players of all time. You could make the argument for greatest player of all time. We can disagree on that. I think he's right there.
Mm-hmm.
But Jordan, there was something about Jordan that was different than LeBron. LeBron's a more complete player. I'll tell you that for sure. He's a much more complete player. But Jordan, and I've only known a few guys in the league like this with that killer instinct. And I always used to talk about this, and I might have even said this on this podcast before. The difference between covering when I covered Bird and McHale, two unbelievable talents. The reason that no one ever thought about McHale in the same vein as Bird was, if Bird had a guy down and he was on the ground, Bird would look at him, step on his larynx, and crush him. McHale would look down and say, yeah, you've had enough, and help him up. And that's the difference between the two of them. And there are very few people like Jordan. Kobe was one of them. Jordan was one of them. Bird was one of them. And Magic was one of them. I'm not sure LeBron is. And I'm not even – and by the way, that might be a compliment because I think LeBron was an incredibly complete player. But I don't know. What do you think of that, Brian? I'm curious what you think
I mean, I know that this is like no duh. You slap your forehead and say, of course. But the thing about Jordan that just absolutely blows you away is the scoring. The guy was just an amazing scorer. He scored in the first quarter of the first preseason game. He scored in the fourth quarter of finals games. He just scored and scored and scored. And in an era where we didn't see that much scoring. I mean, certainly not compared to today's games.
Without the three-point shot,
without the three. He the most.
He was an average three-point shooter anyway. You know, yeah. He really was.
Yeah. So just the way that he's got all of these scoring games, and you go back and look at these playoff performances, 47 here, 42 there, 53 here. You mentioned 63. I mean, if you look at his playoff career, okay, his first year, the first year the Bulls made the playoffs when he was 21, he averaged 29 points a game in the playoffs. That was the lowest he ever averaged in the playoffs. He averaged over 31 every single time, every single following year. I mean, and to score 30 points in a playoff game is hard.
Yeah.
Especially back then where you know, they didn't have the sort of floor spacing that we have today, where there's manufactured scoring.
Not only didn't have the floor spacing, but like the fouls that he took. I mean, he would take multiple fouls a game that will get guys ejected and maybe suspended now.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think
the free throw line was a big way he got the scoring, but even still, it wasn't easy.
And think about the hand checking that went on back then. You know, I mean, people really muscled you back then. Imagine if he was playing today, because he would shoot threes today because they just weren't emphasized back then, and they would be now, and he would be able to do them. I don't know that he'd be Steph Curry, but he certainly would be able to shoot them. I'll tell you another memory I have of Jordan. It was at the end of his career when he was with the Wizards, which everybody would probably choose to forget. Well, one of the things that I remember was, you know, Doug Collins ended up being his coach there. They reunited. I think Jordan always felt badly. I think he felt like somehow he contributed to Collins being replaced by Phil Jackson. And I think he made it up to him by getting, you know, helping him get that job in Washington. And they, those two by that point had a good understanding of one another. And, you know, Jordan was struggling. There were some, it was some, there were some tough nights that final year.
His knee was really degrading.
Yeah. And he just, it was, you know, the game was different. He was different, but people made the mistake of, which you should never do with, again, with someone with that kind of competitive fire, starting to say, well, he never should have played in this season. He can't do it anymore. He can't score. And there was a game where Doug Collins took him out because he just thought, oh, I think you just need to come out of the game. Anyway, go back and look. I don't have the date in front of me. There was a game at the age of 40. He dropped like 45. I wish I had it in front of me. I should have been more prepared. I apologize. Against the New Jersey Nets. And I just remember him afterward, like, oh, yeah? You don't think I can do this anymore? I can. I may not choose to, but I can. Don't you ever think I can. I just never was around anyone that was as competitive as him. Nobody.
And just looking at his basketballreference.com page, he played every game his last season and averaged 37 minutes. That's insane.
Jackie, he actually had 3 40-point games that last year.
That's just one that I happened to be at and one that I remember vividly, you know.
The Nets game, he scored 43.
43, okay.
On 30 shots, yeah. Which is pretty good. He had a game that year against New Orleans where he scored 45.
Yeah.
And he had another game against Indiana where he scored 41. McMahon, did you ever get to see him play live?
I did. I saw him play live in old Reunion Arena in Dallas. And I mean, he was, I don't remember the exact year, but I mean, he was, you know, Michael Jordan in his prime at that point. It was before the first retirement for sure. But you know, he was a champion by then. And I remember that he did not have a dunk in that game. And I don't remember exactly who it was who fouled him, but there was a breakaway. And one of the Mavericks wrapped him up to keep him from dunking. And the entire arena booed that guy.
That's funny. Yeah.
Well,
myself included.
It was just this week. There was the anniversary, I think, of Jordan's last game, or within the last week or two. Of his last game ever in Atlanta, and they moved the game to I guess it was his Bulls retirement, not his Wizards retirement, but they moved because there was such a demand to see it. They moved the game to at the Georgia Dome, and 63,000 people came.
Yeah, I remember that.
To that
yeah.
game.
Yep.
And I'm trying to think. I'm looking for what he scored, but I think he had a good game, like a really good game. Can you imagine that? Like they got 63,000 people, and all of those people are there to see you. You know, I mean, obviously at that point it wasn't like he was afraid of playing in front of crowds, but I'm just saying, like they moved the game to a dome because 60,000 people wanted to see you play for the last time.
But you know. So you guys have been around Jordan. You've seen him live. I mean, you've met him, probably talked with him. There's an aura about him that's just unmistakable. You know, basketball players, when they get in their uniforms, you know, it's hard to look glamorous, but he did. I think you said it. He floated, Tim. He glided. And when he got done and he got showered and dressed and put on the suits and, you know, he was one of the guys that really was in the forefront of all that too. He just looked perfect. Everything about him just oozed.
Well, look, he changed the way the basketball uniforms looked.
Oh, completely.
I mean, you know, I remember, you know, even when I was a young kid, like we had the Stockton shorts, little short shorts. Like I see some pictures whenever I was, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. I'm like, oh my God. And then, you know, I remember like getting into middle school man, you like we would wear those shorts as low as they could go because, you know, the shorts would be like however old and like the coaches wouldn't order the longer shorts. And you'd like, I remember like we'd try to stretch our shorts out because everybody wanted to look like, you know, everybody wanted to wear the shorts like Jordan.
Yeah, he was, and you know, the Dream Team, which of course there's legendary stories about that. And my favorite stories are about how Irvin, you know, Magic was trying to say, oh, well, this is, you know, me and Larry or the whatever. And, you know, Jordan very magnanimously allowed Irvin and Larry to be captains. I mean, he certainly could have been the captain of the team. He just didn't care about that kind of stuff. But he did care one night, you know, and I love it. Bird tells a great story about this when they're all playing pool and they're talking about, well, who is the greatest? And Irvin's like, oh, well, we're all the greatest. And Larry's like, no, Michael's the greatest. And Irvin's like, well, we all, no, you know, and they went through this whole thing. And Jordan, remember now, the Dream Team, he'd go out in the morning dressed impeccably and play 72 holes of golf. Not 18.
He wouldn't play 72.
Yes,
he might play 36 maybe.
He'd play 36. No. 72. At
he
least
could
I'm
not,
I was, now,
he
I was
could
not,
not play 72.
I was not,
he could not play 72.
With the Dream Team? I think he could play 72 and beat Angola.
So I was not there. I was on maternity leave, so I was not at Barcelona. But the stories of him coming in with the bag, and you know, are legendary. And Chuck Daly, you guys know this. It's part of the urban legend of the Dream Team. His whole goal during the Olympic Games was very simple. He didn't want to call one single timeout. And I think it was maybe Patrick that told me this story, that one day Jordan come in, he had played so much golf, and Jordan's like, man, I'm tired. And Daly says, you damn well better not be too tired, because I'm not calling no timeout. And yeah, you know, Jordan went out and dropped 50.
Yeah, well,
whatever.
Chuck used to play with Jordan. Of course, he wasn't playing 36. I stand by 36. I don't believe he's 72.
I wouldn't put it past him, man.
Was he in the casinos the night before and then played 72?
He has an obsessive personality. Don't you know people like this in your life? They have an obsessive personality. It's not good enough for them to play one round of golf or two rounds. It's three rounds or gambling, which, of course, we know got him into trouble. You know, just you can't walk away from the craps table, or you can't walk away from the game of basketball even. He has an obsessive personality, and it's one of the reasons why he's the very best.
I had a complicated, you know, if you were from Cleveland, it was a complicated situation for Jordan in the early 90s when he started winning his titles, because he beat the Cavs in the playoffs three straight times. And, you know, when I was in 1992, the Cavs had the best team they've ever had to that point. They were completely loaded, the 57 games. And they got to the Eastern Conference Finals. They had never been that far before. And got beat by Jordan 4-2. I still remember a grade school graduation party that I had where we watched Game 6, where we were still hoping. It was 3-2. And we were hoping that the Cavs could win and even the series at 3. And just watching, you know, I'm with everybody in my class, and we're living and dying with every basket. And Jordan just strangled them down yet again. And so, you know, he broke that team. And it's one of the things that I always keep in mind over the course of LeBron's career. There's been some really good teams that he's beaten, you know, two or three or four times in the playoffs and just brought them down. And I always, you know, I could relate to those teams and to those fans, because that's, you know, that's what I felt. Now, later on, when he had racked up so much hardware and he was clearly, you know, one of the greatest of all time and everything, you know, mid to late 90s, I mean, it, you know, you dropped the pretense of not liking him because he was just so good. But it was hard, you know, it was just hard to deal with it. It was hard to take it in the teeth, you know, time after time after time, when, you know, you felt like your team was really good. And and that's, you know, for Jordan, I think if you said to him, hey, what was it like playing those Cavs in the 90s? He'd be like, I don't know. Just another bump in the road that I flattened. But, you know, for those of us who had to deal with it, it was hard. So that was complicated. The first time I ever saw him play was in a playoff game at Richfield Coliseum. And I don't remember how many points he had, but the Bulls won. And he was, you know, awesome. So It was hard to see, but I did get to cover him twice when he was a Wizard. In fact, one game that I covered him, he hit a game winner at the buzzer. Somehow he was left open and he nailed it. So I got to see some of that in person. But by the time I saw him up close like that, he wasn't the same player. But
at least you had the Browns playoff success to pick up your spirit.
Yeah, at least we had those AFC title games in a row. Even though we're all at ESPN, we have not been privy. This has all been kept under wraps. We haven't seen any. I haven't seen any of this documentary. Jordan was the executive producer on it. So what I'll be interested to see, Jackie, is, you know, who sat down for interviews. I'm sure everybody he wanted because he was – making the ass.
But they ran out of time. So, for instance, you know, last time a couple of years ago when I talked to Jordan, he said, "Hey, we're doing this documentary. I want them to sit down with you. Will you do it?" I said, "Of course." You know, I was looking forward to it, but it never happened. So I'm not that high up the list. You know, President Obama's in this thing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, all the cast of characters from the Bulls and, you know, Phil and Scotty and Horace and all of them are in it. But they, you know, they got people outside of basketball too, people that he was around, you know, because, you know, I'm sure they have, the folks from Nike in there, you know, he transcended the game, and that's how he and LeBron are the same. LeBron certainly has transcended the game during his tenure. And, I'll tell you, he was just, when you were talking to him, he was so no nonsense. It's so different than today. Like, I remember once he was mad at me because the Bulls had signed Tony Kukoc, and they paid him a lot of money. And, you know, Jordan had no beef with Tony Kukoc. He didn't even know him until they paid him a lot of money. And Pippen, I think they paid him more money than Pippen, or close to it anyway. And then all of a sudden, in an instant, Tony Kukoc is dead to him. Now he's going to be his teammate. And so I get word of some of this, and I'm trying to reach Jordan. Well, good luck reaching him. It's not like we had cell phones back then. I'm not going to call him on his home phone. I don't have his number, you know. But I was around enough of the Bulls back then, enough of the coaches and players, that I knew that Pippen and Jordan were going to give Tony Kukoc the cold shoulder. And this was just Jerry Krause signing. You know, Jerry Krause was very enamored with Kukoc, and Jerry Krause could get like that too. He would fall in love with somebody. You know, he at one point fell in love with this very eccentric coach with a barrel chest from the CBA who coached the Albany Patroons, Phil Jackson. You know, this is how he was. And then later it was, you know, Fred Hoiberg or whoever. And so they made Tony Kukoc's life miserable. So that was the other side of Jordan. There was a side of Jordan that was, I don't want to say petty, but maybe principled, he would probably say.
Jack, you're talking about someone that had a list at his Hall of Fame speech. I think we can see a little bit of pettiness.
Yeah, you're right. But see, one of the things that...
Well, they played that famous game with Team USA against Croatia. Right. And Scotty and Michael pretty much like tackled each other to try to see who would guard him, because they both wanted to...
Right.
I've talked to Scotty about... one of the cool things that's happened in ESPN over the last 3 or 4 years, Scotty has been an analyst for us, and I've gotten a chance to spend some time in the green room with Scottie Pippen. Now, this is a life affirming moment for me, because, you know, I literally as a child, I watched him as a star, and now I am working with him on stage, and we're having basketball conversations. But obviously, whenever he starts talking about his Bulls years, I shut the F up.
Yeah.
He told me the story of the practice, you know, or at least the meeting before they were going to play Croatia, and he and Michael had a disagreement over who was going to get to guard him, or how about they were going to get to guard him, and Michael was not taking no for an answer.
Right. Well, I can tell you when you know, the famous game where Phil drew up the last play. Of course, this is Jordan's in Birmingham playing baseball. He draws up the last play in the playoff game for Tony Kukoc instead of Scottie Pippen. And Scottie refuses to go back on the court. And we actually wrote about this in Basketball, a Love Story, because I also got the chance to talk to Scottie about it. And he, you know, he really felt, and I think he's right, by the way, that Phil really showed him up in that moment. And that it should have been Scottie's right to take that shot at the end of the game. Now, we can debate whether Scotty, you know, if Scotty could do it over, would he go back on the floor? Probably. But I had a much better understanding of where Scotty was coming from in that. But here's the thing. When all that happened, guess where I was? I was on my way to Birmingham, Alabama. Somehow I convinced my – I worked at the Boston Globe at the time. Somehow I convinced them to send me to Birmingham to do a story on Jordan playing baseball. And when I got there, it was the day after this whole thing had happened with Kukoc and Pippen. I wasn't covering the game. I don't know how I talked them into that, but I did. And so I walk up – you know, I don't know Birmingham very well. The manager was this really funny, wisecracking guy named Terry Francona. But anyway, so I'm walking into the dugout. And there's Jordan, and the first thing he does when he sees me, he goes, "Can you believe that?" And I start laughing. And he goes, "I can't believe that." I said, "But yes, you can." He goes, "I can't believe Phil did that to Scotty." I mean, it was just – I couldn't even believe it. I was standing in a baseball dugout, and then the game I was there 2 days. And I'm sorry to report that night, the day we had that conversation, you know, the game was about to start, and that night Michael Jordan struck out 4 times. Curveball. Couldn't hit the curveball.
I wonder in the documentary how much the baseball stuff will be covered, if at all. And, you know, people have never fully accepted the explanations that he had about
right.
leaving. You know, there's always been this, you know, conspiracy, blah, blah, blah. Although I have no information on anything. I would just say that. Anybody who thinks that he was under some sort of secret suspension, you must be crazy.
Right.
Because they would never have suspended him.
Well, you know what? But you know what? So let's just play conspiracy just for fun. This is pie in the sky. This is not to be aggregated. Let's just have some fun with this.
We don't get to decide what's gets aggregated.
Okay. But I'm just saying that the conspiracy theorists, what they thought – and the reason they thought and why this thing actually had some legs, although I don't believe it to be true, but the reason they said it was that he was going to be investigated for gambling in a way that was going to be very embarrassing to the NBA. So their theory goes, well, if you go away and play baseball for 2 years, you can come back. This thing blows over. We're all good. Because maybe, and I don't know, like, believe me, I don't believe this, but there's a lot of very close observers of the NBA that very fervently believed that there was something to this. We'll never know. I don't think we'll ever know. Well, certainly David Stern was never, ever going to tell us. And why would Michael Jordan?
I don't know anything. It just doesn't, it never made sense to
me. Oh, but it's part of the lore, right? It's part of the lore. It's all part of the lore.
Yeah, and, so and I'll just put it to see how, like, how he discusses.
Right, but who does that? Who hasn't played baseball since he was like 18? And then goes and plays double league baseball. And by the way, worked his tail off. The 2 days I was there, he was in the cage. He was taking grounders. He worked harder than any other baseball player when I was there. And Terry Francona told me that. He said, this guy wants it so badly. He's working so hard. But just imagine to be gifted enough to even have a chance like that. And then to come back and just resume being the greatest player we've ever seen in our lives. Pretty
cool. You know what? I kind of wish LeBron would have taken a year or two and gone and played tight end in the NFL.
Oh, he could have. Gosh, he'd be so good.
Dude, I actually talked to when I was covering the Cowboys, I talked to Jason Witten about it. I talked to Dez Bryant about it. They're both like, dude, he's catch like 12 or 15 touchdowns a year.
And he just knocked people over. You know
what was actually amazing? So during the lockout, and this footage is probably on some internet site somewhere. I don't know if any of you guys remember.
Yeah,
this,
the Durant flag football game.
Yeah, so during the lockout, you know, they had nothing to do, so they had a flag football game in the indoor football practice field at the University of Akron, and Durant brought a team from D.C. with his buddies. There might have been some other NBA players in the game. I know Maverick Carter played on LeBron's team because Maverick actually was, in my mind, a better wide receiver than he actually was a basketball player. He went to college to play basketball, but he was a better wide receiver. And watching that game, I went to it. You know, there's no fans there. I just was able to get in. And so I went and watched him. And they hired a crew. Like, they had, like, boom cameras and everything like that. And the thing about watching him play. I mean, I did see him play football in high school, but it was kind of difficult to evaluate him, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But watching him play like safety,
that's
what he was playing. You want to talk crazy, like the ball hawking that he could do, like he would play center field, and good luck throwing any pass that had any air on it, because he would just close the distance, and he's 6 foot – he's actually 6 foot nine. All the guys who lost an inch, you know, when they said because of the gamblers, they had to do measurements, everybody lost an inch. Somebody lost 2 inches. LeBron gained an inch. He actually is 6'9". So he's 6'9", awesome, running out there with incredible hands, incredible footwork. Watching him play safety – now, so you wouldn't have done that because you can't score from the safety position. You would have played him at tight end, but –
He'd have been a 5-inch taller version of Antonio Gates.
Yeah. Gronk, man. He's Gronk.
Well, Gates.
Yeah, Gronk blocked. I'm not sure if LeBron would have wanted to do all that.
But he could.
Gates, I knew very well. I covered him in college basketball player. And he was one of the great athletes that you'd ever see of that size. But with all due respect, he couldn't hold a candle.
He didn't have that kind of explosiveness.
But,
you know,
in high school, when LeBron played, I mean, he played safe. He did not want to get hurt, and I don't fault him for a tenth of a second,
right?
Because But anyway, so I'll be interested to see what happens, like how Jordan discusses the baseball thing, how much of the baseball thing will be in there, and also for a guy, you know, McMahon, you mentioned this is a guy who not only did he hold grudges, he sought grudges out,
yeah.
And considering this is his project, how much of this project is going to be dedicated to the grudges?
Yeah, not only grudges with, you know, other guys in the league, but guys on his team.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the Kukoc stuff, you know, punching Steve Kerr.
He and Steve Kerr get along great.
Didn't he call Will Perdue Will Vanderbilt because he said he wasn't good enough to be Purdue? I always heard that.
I never knew that one. I never knew that.
Oh, my God. That's a great line. He wasn't really a trash talker, was he, though?
Oh, he was. Sure.
Not like a Bird's level.
Well, hard to – you know, that's a whole nother story. But yeah, Jordan, the one guy that I remember that he just wouldn't let anybody get touch was Bill Cartwright. He had great respect for Bill Cartwright and Bill's presence in the locker room and what he did to try to, you know, bring that team together. And that was one of the few guys you couldn't mess with Bill Cartwright. He wouldn't put up with that. He just wouldn't. I'm interested to see what he says about Barkley. You know, those guys were really, really close friends. And they're not as friendly anymore. And I don't really know. I mean, I think it had something to do with, I don't know. I mean,
did Barkley criticize him?
No, I don't think it was more. I think it was more like late night stuff, like gambling. You know, they all gambled, him and Tiger and Barkley and Jordan. They were a threesome for a while. They were really tight. And then when Tiger got in all those trouble, I remember Barkley telling me, like, he was trying to call him to check in on him. And Tiger just, nope. Cut him off. And I think the same thing happened with Jordan too, with Tiger. So
Tiger cut. I've read a couple of books, like including his swing coach. He wouldn't call his coach back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tiger cut everybody off.
So, but I don't really know. Cause you know, like there's when Jordan and Barkley played each other in the 93 finals, 93. That's right. Isn't it? Yeah, I think it is. You know, he was buying buying Barkley gifts. And people think that he just sort of lulled Barkley into this frenemy kind of state where Barkley was, you know, didn't have the edge the way Jordan did. But they were at one time very, very close. So I'm curious about that. I've always been curious about it.
So what he would say about the 93 series, maybe. I mean, I find it hard. That was Barkley's, I guess he thought with the Rockets he might have had a shot, but that was Barkley's shot at a title.
So they played, the story was that I think it was game day or the day before, they played 48 holes of golf together. Huh. And Jordan knew he could do it. 48.
It's all off. Your holes in a day.
No, so this one I'm sure of. You're right. I think the Olympics, they played 36 in the morning, played the game, and then played 36 after the game. But I may be wrong about that, but I know I'm not wrong about this. It was like game four of the finals, and they went out and they played. Look it up. Andrew Hahn.
Well, 48 is just an odd number of holes. You would never play 48 holes.
Yeah, they played 48. Trust me. Look it up. Someone look it up for me. I can't. Shall I do it right now? I'm on a podcast.
No.
You talk. I'll Google.
Johnny Bock was the one that told us. Johnny Bock was the best. Another person that Michael Jordan absolutely adored. Johnny Bock. He thought Johnny Bock didn't get enough credit. You know, Tex Winter got a ton of credit for the triangle and some of the creative things that he did. But he always told me that Johnny Bock was the glue that held that coaching staff together. Another guy that just doesn't get his due. But I'm sure Jordan will give it to. Well, he's probably too much of a bit player, but in the movie. But he loved Johnny Bock. I can tell you that from personal experience talking with him about it.
The other thing that I think will be interesting to see what he says is the Bulls breaking up in 98. Still to this day, I don't understand why they broke up. I mean, I understand at the time there was jealousies and there was issues with what guys were getting paid, and Krause wanted to move on, and Phil Jackson had enough. And like, I've heard all the stories, but it's just hard to believe that any team would go out with an opportunity, you know, especially because they had lost a chance, because they probably would have won eight in a row. No offense to the Rockets. They probably would have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it was Jerry Krause. Listen, he wanted – I did a story for Sports Illustrated on this. I went into Phil Jackson's office and talked with him about, you know, why did it seem like he was going to be out? And he said, you know, Jerry gets enamored with new people. He used to be enamored with me. Like, I think I mentioned that earlier in the pod. Jerry Krause wanted Phil Jackson to move on, and he made sure.
I mean
– that's what happened, I'm telling you.
And they didn't – God, they didn't even crack 20 wins over the next 3 years. That's just to go from winning the title every year to 13-37, 17-65, 15-67, 21-61. Like, what the hell? Floyd replacing Phil Jackson.
Tim Floyd, that's it. Yeah, I said.
Yeah, you said Hoiberg. But,
yeah, I meant Tim Floyd. Absolutely. Yeah. Sorry, that's my mistake. Thank you.
Yeah, I would stay. Whatever.
But it's but so what happened was Phil goes, I don't think willingly, but Will, you know, that's probably in the dock. And then Jordan decides I'm done. And then Jerry Krause is like, well, I'm the best GM in the business. I'm brilliant. I'm going to trade Scottie Pippen. I'm going to get it. I'm going to reboot this and we're going to do it again. Not so much.
Yeah. I can just tell you one of the things that I've learned in my time covering the NBA. Enjoy every championship. I know that sounds kind of like obvious, but it's so hard to do. There's so many things that have to go right. It's such a slog. Enjoy every championship. It's a vital thing. But yeah, I can't wait.
I can't either. I'm so excited. Yeah. So excited.
The other thing is, I was young. I don't really remember so much about it. A lot of stuff I know and will have forgotten. A lot of stuff I won't know. It will be like, you know, for a lot of the stuff, it won't just be reliving it. It'll be like, I'll feel like I'm learning it for the first time on some of this. And, like I remember the game where he made all the three pointers against the Blazers in the,
The shrug game. That was the shrug game. Yeah.
Just the circumstances surrounding that game, the circumstances surrounding the flu game.
Yeah, that was amazing. And even the last one, you know, it crosses over Byron Russell and you're just like, oh my God, he's going to do this again. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Like, you know, so that is now that was 98. So that is, you know, that's 22 years ago.
Yeah, but so, I remember it like it was yesterday. Like the thing about him that
I don't remember anything about the game, Jackie, is my point. I remember the last shot, but I don't remember anything about the game, which is what I'm looking forward to.
It will be fun.
Have all this filled in.
And he was just like, he was a winner. Like there's been great champions, great players. There's, you know, plenty of them. But how many of them had as many game-winning shots as he did? I'm hard-pressed to think of someone else. I just am.
Yeah, I mean, Kobe had quite an array, but he also had quite an array of game of misses.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
volume. You know,
right? Yeah, and you know, but, Jordan. I mean, when I did that story on Kobe when he retired, and Jordan was his idol, and you know, remember Jordan telling me like, I really liked Kobe. He wanted to do everything right, and he kept saying, you know, these guys don't like me, and Jordan kept saying to him, don't listen to him, man. You're different. Embrace being different. Embrace being not the same as these other big guys, because nobody has your unquenchable thirst for winning. And I do think Kobe shared that with Jordan. And, you know, I think Jordan felt a little bad for Kobe in some ways, because as great as Kobe was, he was always compared to Michael, and therefore was always going to come up a little short.
And two things I want to say about Jordan. Made two of the most amazing business deals that any professional athlete ever has. One, you know, basically launched Nike basketball. And mm-hmm. I think it's 5% to this day of the Jordan brand. May even be more. But
I got Jordans on right now. I got a pair of Jordans on as we speak.
Well, that is now
Jordan 1.
That is now
Jordan 1s?
Oh, I don't know. What the hell? I have no idea. I just see his logo and I buy him.
He's out of the league.
Not kidding.
He's out of the league. 17, 18 years now. His shoe brand is a multi-billion-dollar a year brand, and he gets a percentage of all of it. That's number one.
And the apparel too.
Yeah, the new ones are Jordan 34s, but like the ones, the threes, the fours, the 11, like all those things sell like hotcakes still.
So I mean, he is earning more money right now than just about it. I mean, he's probably earned more money than any pro athlete in history. I don't think there's any doubt.
Well, it's the most iconic logo in sports. Name another one that's even close.
Well, Nike, I think, is a more iconic logo, but short of that.
I don't. I'm talking about a person. It's him.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I mean, sure. The Jerry West NBA logo, maybe. It's debatable.
You know what? If you walk down the street and ask 10 strangers who is the logo, they should know, but they don't.
Jerry West doesn't get 5% of every.
No, right. But here's my point. If you walked down the street and had a shirt with a Jordan logo on it and you said, who's that? Everybody would know. Everybody.
Yeah. The other thing is the deal to buy the Bobcats, an absolutely breathtaking business deal. Now, a whole bunch of things had to align for it to happen. Number one, Bob Johnson, who owned the Bobcats, sold them at a loss, which is just about unheard of.
I know,
in modern sports. Secondly, it was at a point where teams were not going for very high, and the NBA was so interested in getting Jordan into the fraternity that they relaxed the rules a little bit on you know, the standard for him to buy was a little bit lower. They would not have probably approved that deal with another buyer. But he really didn't have to. I mean, he wrote a check for tens of millions of dollars, but he didn't have to put the kind of money down that other people would have, which is fine. The NBA owes him a lot more than whatever grant they gave him there. And he bought them at a time where he's turned them into, you know, they're worth at least $1 billion, if not more.
Despite the fact that they make some of the worst personnel moves ever.
He has not been an effective owner. No. I don't think there's any doubt. But the business, just those two. You think about one of the greatest players of all time. I'm not one of the greatest athletes of all time. Obviously, the greatest mm-hmm. basketball player. But he has made two of the greatest business moves, and I mean a bunch of other moves along the way. I mean he's, but those two particularly. All right. So I did want to take a couple of calls before we leave. We're all looking forward to Jordan. So here is this one.
Hey, my name is Manoj, and I'm a long-time listener. And every week, I wait for the new release of the podcast. And I like the conversations, arguments between Jackie Mack, Brian Windhorst, and McMahon. My question to you guys is, you guys seem to know a lot of things, inside stories about the players, teams, and executives. And you share a few details with us. And I guess a lot of players and executives would be angry or uncomfortable based on the details you share. How do you work around this in case if you need to do a story with them or about them in the future? Thank you.
McMahon, you want to tackle that first? You're not afraid to offend anybody.
Well, obviously, you're not going to burn any bridges in terms of off-the-record conversations or things that were told to you in confidence, but kind of the approach that I've always taken is, as long as you're fair and accurate, then, you know, if somebody has an issue with something you say or write or whatever the case may be, then we can have that conversation. But if I know that I'm fair and if I know that I'm accurate, then, you know, I can, they can vent if they don't like it, but you can only be so mad at me.
And don't you find, Tim, that those players end up respecting you because of that?
Or hate me. I mean, there's been...
Not always.
Okay, but yeah. All right. But let's... No, they can still hate you and respect you.
I will say this. The players who have been so mad that they have... And this wasn't podcast stuff. This is more stuff that I've written. The players that have been so mad at me that they refused to talk to me, they weren't around a whole lot longer because I was right. They were mad because I was right. And usually I was right about them about to be heading out of town.
Yeah. It's a good question.
I don't think he's necessarily asking about questions that you or stories that you did write. I think he's asking more about stories that you didn't write, you know, because you were, you know, I mean, and.
Well, and look, here's the thing. If we say it on a podcast, we probably should be willing to write it, because if we don't, Wendy, as you know better than anybody, somebody else will, because it'll get aggregated.
Well,
so I don't think there's a real different standard.
I would say almost every week I say something on the podcast that I shouldn't have said, and Andrew calls me. Andrew, how often do you – I mean, the last podcast we did with Bobby Marks and Who else is on that pod with us?
Don't say the thing that
I won't say what it was, but I think anybody can, you know, you can relate to it. You hear sometimes you know things about people or situations and you can't say it. You know, it's just like any piece of information in life. Some of the stuff you don't say, you know it, but you don't say it. I think the difference here is that your small circle of friends or your classmates, it's not just that. It's just, you know, it would be hundreds of thousands of people who would be interested in hearing that. So you got to, the stakes are a little higher. But I don't know. I'm the wrong person to ask, because I've got myself in hot water at times for saying stuff I shouldn't have said, Jackie.
Well, you know that this happens to me quite often as well. But I don't know. I generally think, I might be wrong. I think if you're honest and you have something – you know, if you have a criticism of a player, I often used to say to them, well, here's what I'm going to write. Talk me out of it. And sometimes they could, and sometimes they couldn't. And when they could, I didn't end up writing it. When they couldn't, they knew it was coming. I think the hard times are when you say something that criticizes or calls into question someone's integrity or character. I think that's when players really get upset. And that's when you can get yourself into trouble. And that's when you might get some backlash, and deservedly so. I mean, if you're going to criticize or make or report something that's controversial, you need to be available and willing to take the heat that comes with it. That's part of our job. It's, you know, everyone thinks we have the most glamorous, fun job. You get to hang around all these athletes and talk to all these athletes. Well, that's the other side of it, that if we're doing our job properly, if everybody loved us, we're not doing our job. I mean, that's just the truth.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, like, I literally have off-the-record conversations not to be shared every single day. Even with the league shut down, today I had a call with a high-ranking person and about stuff that's happening right now that is sensitive. And, like, it was like, look, you know, this is off the record. I had somebody else today share with me a secret that if I said it right now, I guarantee would be significant news across the Twitter sphere. Like, and it's, I'm not even trying to tempt you. Like, it happens every single day. So, you know, part of it is the nature of our business. One of the things that's interesting about our jobs is we swim in the neutral zone. In between them, we don't show up to games with an NBA team on our shirt like everybody mm-hmm. else. So as a result, sometimes because of that, we sort of are arbiters and are privy to things, and it's the nature of the job. You know, there was a time where a team actually was interested in hiring me. They wanted to hire me to be an information person. You know, hey, we need you. I'm going to give you assignments. Go find out why this guy isn't playing here, why this guy may want to get traded and everything like that. And I didn't think I could do the job because I thought my whole training, my whole background was being in the middle and not having – being a neutral party for the most part and being able to operate that way. I didn't think if I all of a sudden started wearing shirts with that team's logo on that I would be able to get access to the same information. I would become an adversary, not an arbiter or not a neutral party. So
although that is part of the job of a lot of like the pro scouts, not advanced scouts, not the guys who are worried about play calls and that stuff, but the pro scouts, that's a big part of their job is basically to stay on top of the NBA gossip.
Which is why they talk to all of us to get it.
Yeah.
To get it.
But, you know, the thing is, right? So the best stories are the ones we don't write. That's sort of the adage in our business. But it's important at some point to write some of them. Don't we agree?
Really?
That's the thing you're always doing value judgments on. So, all right, well, if you have a question for us, we have more. And by the way, we have a lot of these, and we will get through some of them because I know some of you have called back and said, you didn't answer my question. Well, we'll try to get there. But, Andrew, what is the phone number?
402-316-2955. If you come up with a jingle for it, maybe that will help.
A Jackie, jingle?
If you want to come up with it.
A jingle?
You know, like
402-3-9. What is it?
What is it again? Give me the number. I'm on this.
402-316-2955.
I don't really have a little ring to it.
Did you guys have Garfield 12323?
I'd rather bring back the Bam McMahon theme song than have a jingle.
Hey y'all, it's Hoop Collective Live, 402-316-2955.
It's Bam McMahon.
There you go.
Bam McMahon, Texas blood, thick as mud.
I used to have it twice a week on Dallas Radio, but I got I'm on radio furlough right now, unfortunately.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to the Hoop Collective. Thanks for listening to our memories. And we will be talking to you in another couple of days. Who knows what we'll talk about then. Enjoy the rest of your week.